All right, welcome into the latest edition of the That's So Cincinnati podcast. I'm Paul Eaton Jr. here with my man Jason Williams of Politics Extra fame. We're back at it. We're back at it again. Big episode.
Huge. You know, I don't wake up on Tuesdays as we record this until I hear you say, all right, we're back. That wakes me up.
That wakes you up. You just pretty much just
1 o'clock, 2 o'clock.
You're in a malaise until I wake and until I shake you.
Now I'm ready to roll.
Now you're ready to go. Well, I'm good. I'm glad you're ready to roll. We got a lot to get to. We're going to start off. We're going to talk a little bit about Sherry Coolidge. She's our good friend, Sherry Coolidge.
Good friend of the show.
Sherry Coolidge had a great story this weekend. Really what we're all about here, the watchdog stuff, because it was about who is not showing up in city council. I mean, literally the bottom line least you can do is attend. So she dove deep into the numbers of who did and did not, has not been attending council meetings. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and kind of dive into that. We've got reader email that we're going to get to. A reminder to everybody, if you get a chance, you like the show, you're listening, or you read one of Jason's columns and you want us to answer one of your questions, you have an idea for a future topic, anything you got, you can email Jason at
jwilliams@enquirer.com.
jwilliams@enquirer.com. And you can be famous like our reader email that we're going to have coming up at the end of our first segment here. Also, our guest this week, John Schroeder, who I love these interviews because we're able to really go all over the place in different portions of the world, but always with a Cincinnati tie. John Schroeder, who is a Covcath grad, but has become a big-time documentary filmmaker. You might know him from the Incredible Dr. Pohl show. He's on Nat Geo Wild. He's been a producer and creator of that, which is like 13 seasons, 9 years worth of shows. But anyway, he's now taking his attention to doing kind of a passion project, you should say, documentary on the Covcath incident, and he's in the midst of doing that right now. So he's going to talk to us a little bit about that, about his career and some other stuff. That's a Cincinnati moment coming.
Yeah,
I think I got a good one. I think I got a good one that a lot of people relate to that live here that I experienced this past weekend. So excited about that. And also a reminder, next week's show, one of my favorites, my good friend Aaron Sharp is going to join. He is really, he's been at the forefront of Bachfest for a long time, and Bachfest is just one of my favorite weekends of the year. He also used to run WNKU and then opened up a business, Lucius Q, in Pendleton. And Pendleton is such an interesting area of the city right now that not enough people are talking about. So a lot of different topics to talk to him about, including goats and monks, I'm all about. We talk about Bachfest.
You know what Bachfest is?
It's a celebration of the open of spring in Cincinnati.
Well, it's also so Cincinnati.
It is very, very Cincinnati. That's coming next week on That's Cincinnati. Excited to have Aaron come and join us. But let's talk about this week. Can I just open this up to you to answer this to somebody like me? Why would someone not show up to a city council meeting?
First of all, you can always ask me any questions.
That's where I'm asking you. Why would that be the case? Where we have a lot of people that have not.
Why, if you're on council, why you wouldn't show up?
Why would you? How could it be a situation where you don't show up? Outside of obvious excused absences that do happen, there are certain things, but that there's a lot of basically, I would call it unexcused absencing that Sherry references in her story here.
Why you wouldn't show up? There's a general climate at City Hall where the attitude is, I don't have to show up. I'm above it, or I don't really have to answer any questions or anything because the people elected me and I got here. And
didn't they elect them to be there?
Yeah, they did elect them to be there. I'm just sharing my observations of some of why we're seeing some absences, and I particularly think that is the case with Tamaya Denard, who's in her second year on council. So in her rookie year on council, she missed 6 full council meetings, which was almost double the amount anyone else missed. Chris Seelbach missed 4, and then it went.
Chris Smitherman had 4.
Christopher Smitherman had a legitimate reason, who was taking care of his terminally ill wife, who unfortunately has since passed away. And again, condolences to the Smitherman family on that. But you know, if you're going out of town, or you have a sick, you're sick yourself, or you have a sick family member, people understand that, but I'm not sure that's what's going on right now. So
the six number equates to over 17% of total of the total number of meetings.
It's not a good look for a first year elected official who's really I really feel like probably your first year in elected office. You're trying to build credibility. You're trying to show people, hey, what, you know, fulfill your campaign promises. And I know she has worked on some of that stuff, but it's just, there's a sense of, it just sends a message to miss that many meetings. It's like, are you almost kind of flouting your duty to the public by not showing up at the meetings? And it's just not a good look.
Yeah. Going down the list, Jeff Pastor, 3, Wendell Young, 3, Amy Murray missed 3, P.G. Sittenfeld missed 1, Greg Landsman missed 1, and David Mann, perfect. Did not miss any.
And I think that says so much that David Mann, who's been on council several different go-arounds, over 25 years, combining all of his terms, and he sat out, obviously, for a while. But for him, if there's anyone you would say, like, oh, you know what, if you miss one, that's okay, it would be him. But he misses 0, and I think that really says a lot about him, that he's there and committed, and he set an example for some of the younger, or, you know, newer council members. Whereas on the other side of the spectrum, you had a first-year freshman council member miss the most.
Yeah, I mean, David Mann very simply says, I don't know how you can participate if you don't go to the meetings. It's so simple and it's so true. This is just kind of a mind-blowing thing to me. I mean, I think any of us can take our jobs, right? Whether here or wherever you're listening to, whatever it is that you do. You know, at the beginning of your year, I mean, council really knows what your schedule is, when you need to be at certain things, when things happen. I mean, for in my case, I cover the Bengals. We know that we don't plan vacations in the fall.
Right.
Like, that's just not something that you can do. And there's certainly Sundays are out for planning big family get-togethers and things like that. So you know that going into things. When you're on council, you know when you can and cannot do things. So it's just mind-blowing to me that anybody would not want to be there. Like, shouldn't you want to be there? And I guess we can bemoan all this for a while. Do you feel like this particular topic and some of these numbers are indicative of why not enough gets done over there? Or are they not connected?
I don't necessarily think they're connected, but I think it is indicative of sort of the general attitude there of just the there's a lot of dysfunction. We've talked a lot about that on this episode. We've written a lot about it on Cincinnati.com. There's just such really deep political divisions between the progressives and the moderate Democrats and the Republican, the few Republicans that are there. And you just put this on top of that. So not a good look. You've got to show up. This is the time. Here's the thing with council. They get paid $65,000 a year, full medical retirement benefits. But it's really not that. If you can do it by working about 5-6 hours a week. You have to show up at your committee meetings on Mondays and Tuesdays, which are a few hours, or, you know, it could be 3-5 hours. And then you have the main council meeting typically on Wednesday afternoons at 1:30. Public comment starts. And depending on the issue, you know, you can get out of there within an hour sometimes. Sometimes within it takes 5 hours. But other than that, that's a pretty good salary to be making to only really have to show up to, you know, 2 or 3 meetings a week over. And you also get a 2-month break at Christmas time. All right, you get a 2-month break in the summer. You get a nice break over the holidays, and you need to be showing up at a meeting, because that's where the public expects to see you and see you voting on things that affect them.
And being
informed.
That's
why it's important to be there.
I mean, really, even just listening, I mean, because you mentioned the committees. I mean, everybody's on a committee, and our man Mike Nyergis, who runs all these numbers, creates all our great graphics for us, you know, has it run down here, and you can go to Cincinnati.com and read more about the story, which is all kinds of great information in there. Just committees alone, Tamai Dinar missed 17.7%, Chris Smitherman 14%, Amy Murray 14%, Wendell Young 14%, Jeff Pastor 12.6%, Chris Steelback 10.3%, Greg Landsman 7.2%, PG Sittenfeld 4.8%, David Mann 1.3%, one of 79 committee meetings you missed. I mean, so any of those numbers, and I thought the story is really interesting. It goes back and kind of talks, you know, looks back at some of from way back. This is a new thing, new era, newer thing, right? I mean, it seems like where it's there's this new sense of not needing to be there that didn't necessarily exist from those who, and I hope it doesn't. I don't think it's one of those. Back in my day, we used to show up at council meetings, right?
Right.
But it legitimately is just the way things were done, and you know, also things seem like they got done a little bit more back then, and there was more working together. Whereas now, you know, you've got people not showing up, you've got people not working together, you've got the Gang of Five text message garbage and all this stuff. It's like, you know, it's all in the melting pot together a little bit.
Yeah, when you throw this on top of all those things you just listed, the Harry Black saga last year. The violation, or what appears to be a violation, of open meetings laws with the text messaging meeting between the five, some people call them the Gang of Five, the five progressive Democrats. So the fighting that's gone on the FC Cincinnati Stadium. So then you throw this
on. FC. They got their mention. They're in.
You throw this on top of all that, and it's just one more thing that I feel like I feel like a lot of people aren't paying attention to City Hall, but every time something like this happens, it's like you erode the public trust just a slight little bit more. I want to point this out before we jump to something else. The thing that bothered me most in Sherry's piece that was on Cincinnati.com yesterday, or actually still is on Cincinnati.com, was a quote from Wendell Young when he was asked about his absences and the importance of showing up at council meetings. Young, this is, I'm reading from the piece. Young, along with Amy Murray and Jeff Pastor, missed 3 of 38 regular council meetings. He put it this way, quote, "When I miss a council meeting, I do it according to the rules, which say I don't have to provide a reason. If the public has a problem with that, they need to change the rules." I took that as a real slap at the public and maybe even a slap at the critics who are, I'm not taking it as, this is not personal. I've been critical of him, on his term on council. And one of the things I've been critical of was that he just skipped an entire week of council back in 2017 around the Children's Hospital expansion votes.
Right.
And it's held up the vote, actually, because they needed him there to have enough people to vote. And, you know, so there's clearly an importance of showing that how important it is to show up, because there are massive taxpayer money on the line on these votes and on a lot of these votes. And it's your job to be there to show up. And so to sort of slap back at the public or the critics and say, well, the public needs to change the law, it's like, no, you just need to show up.
You seem to show up. I mean, I agree with you on that. Look, yeah. I just wanted to make, that needed to be at the forefront. You know, they did great work on that story. And it's really, it just shows you where a lot, I think it's a great view into some of the things that are happening and why some of the things aren't happening over at City Hall right now. Let's jump into our email of the week. Jason, you've got a thanks to everybody that sends in emails, and a reminder, you can send them in to Jay Williams at inquirer.com. If you want to hear an email, or you have a question that you'd like to hear us dive into, or anything, topic, whatever you're is on your mind, you listen to That's in Cincinnati, send it to Jason, and we'll tackle it here in this segment every week. So what do we got this week?
We had an email from Tyler Broadbeck. I hope I'm saying that right. Yeah, Tyler Broadbeck, who's a loyal listener, and he pointed out, he's like, you guys talked about this back in December, and he actually sent us an email then and then just resent it to me because I don't remember seeing it, but thanks for resending it, Tyler. And he says, you know, you guys talked about U.S. Bank Arena. Did we talk about U.S.? We did.
Yeah.
We talked about the banks and all that. He's like, the place is a dump. Even Nick Lachey dumped on it a few weeks back in the Inquirer. And his question is,
when Nick Lachey dumps on it, you know it's bad.
So here's what he has to say. Is it ever going to be renovated? Can someone else buy it? You know, going to a concert is a nightmare. I went with my family to a Garth Brooks concert last year, and they closed all but two of the men's restrooms. They used those closed men's restrooms for women's restrooms, and the guys' lines were wrapped in opposite ways around the concourse. We lost the RNC convention a few years back because it's such a dump. His question again is it ever going to be renovated, and can someone else buy it?
I mean, the only way it will ever be renovated is if someone else buys it. And the problem is Nederlander Group that owns it doesn't seem to have any intention of selling that building. They, if you don't know much about them, I mean, they're everywhere. They have arenas and facilities all over the place. This is one of them. So it's kind of they're not really local here. It's a drop in their bucket. It's just one of the things that they operate in and let it go. I mean, they're ridiculous. Whatever the video of this is what it could look like, the renovate, all you got to do is give us the money, it's honestly one of the most absurd things that has happened in this city in a long time. I mean, I've told this story a million times. It's a total equivalent of me creating a YouTube rendering of a $2 million expansion on the back of my house in Oakley and saying, all right, here it is. Who's paying for? Who wants to build this for me? You know, because there's no, I mean, does the city need one? Yes, of course it does. But that money is not there, and Nederland Group has no plans on doing it. I mean, UC, this really came to the head when UC was looking for a place, even for 1 year, to play basketball, and
they took a pass.
They'd rather go to NKU than deal with US Bank Arena when. Downtown, I mean, they'd had games down there. It's a great fit for UC down there. Everything but the arena and dealing with Nederlander Group. And there's no tenant. You have no tenant. Yeah. You're not going to renovate something without a real tenant. Sorry, Cyclones. Appreciate your Kelly Cups. But ooh, it's not about...
fired up.
No, but the US Bank arena thing makes me mad because you have to have a real tenant. You have to have a real ownership group that is invested in that facility to really make something happen. And they're not. They're not. Yeah. And they would rather the city just pile money onto them. And that's never a thing that's going to happen. And it doesn't look like they're going to sell it.
And it's unfortunate, too, because when we're looking around at our peer cities, Indianapolis has a beautiful arena and also has Lucas Oil Field, which we know is can be used for Final Fours. And
Louisville. Columbus.
Louisville has a Yum Center, Columbus, Nationwide Arena.
All these places, even Lexington now, Rupp gets more money poured into it. I mean,
and that's why these places get NCAA tournaments after NCAA tournaments and other big concerts that pass us by. It's a big reason why, because I believe all those arenas in those other cities we just mentioned are owned, are municipal arenas, I'm pretty sure. We're going to continue to miss out on conventions like the Republican National Convention, the Democratic National Convention. They won't look at us. Again, NCAA tournaments. The big issue, Tyler, is obviously money. And there's such a small pot of money, and it's the hotel tax money. And I don't know all the details off the top of my head about how much that generates a year. But the problem is you have a lot of people trying to claw for that money. You have the actual convention center trying to get some of that money, and some of that money helps run the convention center. We need a new convention hotel. The Millennium Hotel is, speaking of dumps, so you've got a group that's going to be wanting their hand in the till for that money, which would be the same money the arena would want, the same fund the arena would want money from as well. So highly competitive. You throw in that it's a privately owned arena, and... we have what we have.
You have what you have. And now a new music venue at some point being built to help alleviate some of you're not getting the big events, but at least some of the daily entertainment that you need to keep the banks alive. You can at least start to draw by the music venue that you have down. I mean, it's nothing like you could get if US Bank Arena was pulling in big name after big name. However, it's something, and the banks desperately needs it.
Don't hold your breath on that outdoor music center, by the way.
Still trucking along on that path. Yeah, exactly. All right. Let's do interview time here. We're going to bring in John Schroeder and talk to him a little bit about his Covecath documentary project, amongst other things. And then we'll be back later for That's the Cincinnati Moments. Now on the That's a Cincinnati podcast, and I feel like when we do these interview segments, we're all over the map. You never know who we're going to bring in here, which is part of what I love about this podcast, except that there's going to be a Cincinnati tie, and we're kind of doing that again. I'm excited about this one. John Schroeder's here with us, a Nat Geo producer, co-executive producer and creator of the Dr. Pole Show, which had
the incredible Dr. Pole
13 seasons. 9 years you've been doing that, and now you're starting working on a documentary around the Covecath situation. So there's a lot going on. Welcome, thanks for jumping on TSC with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I was going to say, can we just go into your background first of all, just to give people a little bit of a base Covecath, you went to Covecath?
Correct, graduated in 92.
Covecath, Eastern Kentucky, and then you sort of ended up going to New York and getting into the film. Take me through kind of your career and how you ended up where you are now, just a little nutshell for us.
Well, in high school, I was really only good at two things, writing and football.
Yeah.
So played a lot of football. I was the captain of the football team at Covecath, and I had this English teacher named Mrs. Bricking, and she really encouraged me to write. She really liked my short stories. She really liked my poetry. But being a football player at the time, I was like, I'm a football player. I don't want to be a poetic football player. I just want to kind of focus on that. But I went to Eastern Kentucky University. Went there and really didn't have any idea of what I wanted to do.
Hold on a second. John was recruited by none other than the Marshall Thundering Herd.
Oh, wow.
He tells me. Sorry, I just had to interject there.
But you decided they weren't strong enough because
he was ready to move on from football. So anyway.
Thanks for mentioning that.
Sorry for breaking the flow.
You can drop Marshall in there, I know.
Go Herd. And go John.
So when I went to Eastern Kentucky University, I originally majored in psychology. I think I like Frasier from Cheers, and I thought that would be cool to say I was a psychology major. But then a buddy of mine was studying film and television. I'm like, what? You can actually study that? So I was handed a camera, and I learned how to edit, and I learned how to shoot, and I had this writing skill. And so if I could bring all those three together, it was like, man, I was like a fish in water. I loved it. From the first video class that I took at EKU, I'm like, this is what I want to do. So when I was 19, I went through the Yellow Pages and just picked on-location video production. It was on 12th and Walnut there in the Germania building. So I called them up, and I said, hey, I'd like to intern and see what it's all about. And same thing. I went there. I interned for 3 months, and I absolutely loved it. And the more I studied it, and the more film that I shot, and the more video that I edited, the more I was like, I'm in, this is exactly what I want
to
do.
Before we kind of get to the documentary, I think you have a great story to tell about the journey of your career and perseverance. And I really want you to share that. And that's, so you had done a lot of jobs in the world of television and movies, and you get to, what was this? Somewhere at some point, the Screenwriters Guild strike hits, and you're writing scripts in Los Angeles, and you're pretty much out of work.
Mm-hmm.
Can you pick it up from there, and where you went to work, and how that led to where you're at today with a successful National Geographic show?
Sure. After Jimmy and Judy was released, it's an independent film that I co-wrote and co-directed. I received quite a bit of work as a screenwriter, and I was pretty certain at the time that this is what I was going to do for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. It was never occurred to me I would do anything different. So I had a good stretch of screenwriting. Wait,
let's, you want to talk about Jimmy and Judy real quick, which was shot here?
If you do.
You dinged me a little bit because I called it a box office dud, but you also, it was, it won, what, 3 awards, independent film awards, and in that regard, and
yeah,
turned a profit in that regard, was a success.
Yeah.
I think most, I think I wrote this in a column, you know, a lot of people in greater Cincinnati were, might remember it as, the lead actor, Edward Furlong, going, taking a night at Meyer in Florence and, going to the seafood counter and taking the live lobsters out of the tank and running around the store, I believe.
Yeah. I was really upset with him at the time.
You were? Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to ask you about.
He was our lead actor, and, you know, he had had some issues before. So before we stepped foot on set, we met with him like, just behave yourself. Don't do anything stupid. 3 days later, he was arrested at the Myers for being drunk and running around with lobsters. But at the time, I was really mad. But the next day, we were mentioned on Howard Stern. We were mentioned on Jimmy Kimmel. We were in New York Post, page 6. It was national news that he was running around with lobsters. And the way he framed it was, I'm an animal rights activist. So we got PETA involved, and we got even more
publicity. So it generated publicity for the movie.
Yeah. I was like, thank you. Thanks to your drunken shenanigans, you got us millions of dollars worth of free publicity.
And I read a story, I think it was on E! Online, in which you actually bailed it. You had to bail him out of jail.
Yeah. My little sister and I just cringed. Nice. I think she was still at UK at the time. We showed up at the Boone County Jail and apologized to the police, and he still felt very passionately he didn't do anything wrong. But I guess in Hollywood, it would be cool to run around drunk with a bunch of lobsters, and the cops would probably say, go home. But this is Boone County, son.
As a piece of work in your 20-plus year career, where does Jimmy and Judy, the movie, sort of rank for you? It was a passion project, right? Because you filmed it back here at home, and...
Yeah, you know, it was a great part of my career. It opened a lot of doors for me, especially in the screenwriting world. Mm-hmm. You know, we were a small crew, 10 to 15 of us, you know, our director of photography, a couple producers. They came here and just fell in love with the place. But I had to convince them that mm-hmm. Cincinnati was the perfect place to make this movie. I actually wrote it with bringing a crew to Cincinnati because, okay. You know, my mother lived here, my dad lives here, all my CovCath friends live here. And so if I wanted extras for a party, which we had a lot of in the movie, it wouldn't be a problem to get people to show up.
So fast forward to Screenwriter's Guild hits within, I think, right around that, not long after that. And you find yourself out of work and you land a job moving furniture and props at a Nickelodeon warehouse in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And at a time when it was, we'll just take it from there. That was a tough time for you, right?
Yeah, it was very tough. The screenwriting work started to dry up even before the screenwriting strike happened. Mm-hmm. And I was in line to write and direct another film, which at the time looked like I was going to be on my way to making another feature film. Mm-hmm. But the screenwriter strike hit, and then it was about a good year I was without an income. So I was forced to take a job. Not forced. A buddy of mine had a job at the Nickelodeon warehouse. And this warehouse had all kinds of weird props and swords and paintings. And it was like the museum of all things weird, plus mm-hmm. furniture. So we were moving furniture in and out. We would, if like there was a new production happening, we would set them up with facts. It was basically a moving guy job.
Yeah.
So the guy that got me the job there, his name was Charles Pohl. And as we would drive through Los Angeles on our deliveries, he would tell me these insane stories about his dad. He told me this story when he was 10, maybe 11 years old. It was Christmas Day, and his dad didn't want to be apart from his family, but his dad was on call. And if he gets a call, it doesn't matter if it's Christmas or 2 in the morning.
His dad's a veterinarian in Michigan, rural Michigan.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if his dad gets a call that a cow is giving birth, he goes. It doesn't matter when it is. So to keep the family together, he brings Charles and his two sisters along with him to this farm call. And it ends up Dr. Pohl had to give the cow a C-section. So little Charles and his two little sisters are each holding a cow's stomach. And there's a cow has five stomachs. So you have to hold three of them outside while Dr. Pohl pulls out the calf. And so the calf lived. They were covered in blood. They put the stomachs back into the cow, and everyone lived happily ever after. But he had dozens and dozens of stories like this. And so I said, Charles, if this is the case, why don't we just go out there and film him for a little bit, see what's happening?
So, again, I don't want to belabor this too much, but I love how you film him. You go out and you film, and one of the things you film him doing is castrating a horse. And tell us how that went, because you really, in that, you saw the character of Dr. Pohl. You saw a real potential reality TV star in that.
Right.
Right. Whatever he was doing there.
Yeah. And I had never seen a horse castration. I don't know how many people have actually witnessed a horse castration. I've seen it so many times now that I could probably do it myself. But at the time, it was pretty shocking. He knocks the horse down. He tranquilizes it. Then it lands down with a big crash. You know, 1,500 pound animal crashes to the ground. He hoisted its legs up. And at this point, like, I'm starting to sweat. Like, oh, man, what's going to happen next? He slices into the scrotum. He pulls out the testicles, and then he crunches the cord I think is the vas deferens.
Okay.
So he crushes it. That's difficult. That's probably the worst part. But then after he slices them off, he looks at them, and they're big, and he looks at me, and he throws them right at the camera, and he goes, "That's how you do it!" And he's all excited. It was like he was doing his own version of the Icky Shuffle. He's just so happy with himself.
So so you guys film, what, four episodes? You take it back, and National Geographic orders it up, and here you are 9 years later on the most successful show on Nat Geo Wild, The Incredible Dr. Pohl. And that's just really a cool story.
It's unbelievable how it all kind of came together. It's like catching lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
Like, talk about being in the right place at the right time. And to think audiences would be into that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I was horrified at the footage that I was showing these networks.
Seen a lot.
Yeah. But when you sell it, you have to go and meet with these different networks. And I just remember the looks on some of these executives' faces. Like, they couldn't even watch our sizzle run. Like, oh, thanks for coming. That was great.
Wow.
Oh, my God. Yeah. But can I say just one thing?
Yeah.
Reality show. I kind of have a problem with that being described as a reality show just a little bit. I know technically it may be considered a reality show, but reality shows, funny enough, aren't reality. We document what's happening. Nothing we do is fake. We can't do, okay, take two, Dr. Pohl, put that cap back in. We didn't get it. I mean, we get we get, and that's it. And there's no giving Dr. Pohl lines. He says what he wants to say.
Gotcha. So in reality TV, though, a lot of times there's a lot of scripting that goes on.
It's mostly fake.
Have you watched reality TV before?
I don't watch a lot of TV. but when I think of reality TV, I think, to me, like, that's what you're doing now is really the purest form of it, right? Because it actually is real.
If reality TV was real, that would be reality TV.
Yeah.
Thank you for clearing that.
Maybe all the way back to the real world, like the original reality show where it was supposed to be literally like just here's people. But now even the situations you put them in are really setups. But I'm not going to go down a reality TV.
We have time.
I'd prefer not.
Cuff cast stuff.
Yeah, that's where I was going with this. I said, I'm not going to go down the reality show wormhole. I do want to know, I mean, why did this perk your interest so much? And when you're, is it just seeing it, the viral nature of it that really got you, or what was it, why this stood out to you so much?
When I originally watched the video out of context with those horrible headlines, it was, they interrupted a peaceful protest. It was a Vietnam War veteran. There was the rape sentence that the kid said. And when you combine that headline with that video taken out of context, it looks really awful. And I reacted. So immediately I got my laptop open. I started drafting an email to the principal. I started to engage with my friends that went to CovCath, my outrage. And then as more information of the video started to come in, I just realized that I was wrong. I was wrong to react. I was wrong to judge these kids. And I felt like many, maybe more than just myself, maybe many people went through the same sort of journey that I did to judge these kids without knowing the entire story. And I fell for, what really got me going is when the Washington Post and the New York Times reported on the incident without fact checking, because they ran with the original story and CNN did too. So I figured if the Washington Post, CNN, and the New York Times, they're reporting on it, it just has to be true. How could it not be true? Mm-hmm.
The outrage culture, I think that's kind of been really the side effect of this, where it's not even about what everyone was originally outraging about. I think the story has now turned into more of just the latest example of what outrage culture becomes. Is that kind of a driving force behind why you want to do this and what this maybe the, I don't know if there's a lesson, the lesson might end up being in the story you tell?
Well, I'm trying to show people that this was a very complex situation with multiple layers. It's not just kids yelling in a Native American's face. There's a culture at Covecast. There's how the media reported. It's the camera angles. It's the black Israelites that no one seems to be outraged about. When you know, I'm making the documentary now and you ask about the black Israelites, the comment is, well, they're crazy, you know. But where's the outrage? These were adults. The Native Americans were adults. The Covecast kids, they're 15, 16 years old. So I'm trying to give the Covecast students and the alumni a platform to tell their story because you don't hear it.
Yeah.
But you're telling this, but what I like about this, and I was honored to be interviewed for the documentary. And thank you for that again. I get just great questions, great perspective, fair questions that you asked, questions about, you know, my approach as a columnist to it and the media and all that stuff. I mean, you're trying to hit all different angles in this piece, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'm going to present the information to the audience and let them decide for themselves about the situation.
Yeah, that's great. When can we expect, when and where can we expect to see this?
Well, right now my focus is on just getting it completed. Once it's complete, I'll hit the market with it, but I think mm-hmm. I would be able to have a version of it completed within 6 to 9 months.
Mm-hmm. And you know, ideally, this ends up on Netflix or Amazon Prime or HBO?
That would be great. Netflix, yeah. Amazon Prime, HBO. And it's great that these channels exist. You know, they're making documentaries cool again. Everyone's talking about documentaries. And mm-hmm. back in the day, the only people talking about documentaries were like film nerds and academics. And documentaries are where it's at.
And you have your Nat Geo crew working on this. Like, you've set up a studio in your downtown Cincinnati condo.
Right.
And you had your top people working on this project.
Yeah, what an honor. I mean, those guys are so talented. Mm-hmm. It felt like an old indie film, you know. We had our audio supervisor sleeping on our couch. We had the co-executive producer sleeping on a blow-up mattress, and we all just kind of lived there together for the past 9 days and just hammering out these interviews.
Yeah.
It's been a great experience. They just left the other day, and so my wife's like, is it boring now? Like, just having a place to ourselves.
Yeah. Your wife, who's a Cincinnati native, who you met in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Yeah. So
gotta give her a shout out.
Yeah.
Cincinnati, shout out to Megan Schroeder.
Yeah. So are you just canvassing anybody associated with the situation at all to talk about this, pretty much anybody that you can? Is that include, I mean, are you Nathan Phillips, or like, where are you at with some of those other people that were involved there in Washington?
Well, I'm starting with Covenant Catholic, and I'm starting with locals. Then I'm going to branch out further next week. I'm going to be reaching out to Nathan Phillips and basically anyone who has an interesting perspective on the situation. They don't have to be directly involved in the incident, but anyone who I think has something to say worthwhile about it.
Yeah. Which can be anywhere. I mean, you know, I think when you end up, I'm assuming you're going to look at Washington Post, New York Times, those types of people, you know, the same way that you do locally here, because the reporting of it, the reaction of it, and the viral nature of it, I just think is really, to me, has it's turned into one of the most interesting things, because it has nationally and really most places, it feels like it just disappears. It disappears, right? You know, just like it always does. It's got its cycle and it's gone. And I just find it seems like that's kind of the interesting now to watch. And so I think that's such a great idea that you have, because to really watch, because no one ever watches the finality of it. No one ever watches the fallout. It's just, it shows up, it's viral for 24 hours. And then forever, most people, it just disappears. But really, the life of it, the timeline on it is much longer, which is a cool thing to show.
Thank you. And maybe that next time there's a viral video, especially with kids in it, maybe people will think twice before threatening them with physical violence via Twitter or bomb threats or death threats. The outrage was horrible. The things that were said to these kids online, just unbelievable by celebrities.
What was I going to say? I love that it's a Covcath guy who has your experience and your knowledge and your perspective, and a local from Greater Cincinnati. Is there a better producer, documentarian to do a piece on this than you? I don't think so. And I think you bring that. I think you said for my column over the weekend was, you said this is extremely personal.
I don't know who's better. I'm sure there's tons of better producers out there. But as far as this documentary, every filmmaker wants to do a personal project. Mm-hmm. And this is extremely personal to me, and I have very strong opinions about it. And I'm going to hold those opinions back and let everyone decide for themselves based on the opinions of the people who are participating in my documentary. But now I feel, I don't want to say lucky to be a part of it, but I'm glad I'm here, and I'm glad I'm the one that's able to do it.
Cool. That's awesome. John, thanks so much for coming and joining us. If you get a chance, you're like, listen, go watch Jimmy and Judy, right?
Yeah. Or watch Dr. Pohl's show.
Dr. Pohl's show. I mean, I'm interested now. Maybe we can, I'm going to go right to the porcupine episode. I've heard stories about that. I'm probably going to skip over the horse castration. I just feel like that's just not a good place to start. You got to build up to that a little bit, you know?
This is the part of the show where I add something at the end, even though we're trying to close. So,
I don't think you have anything to add.
No, I do. I grew up in the country, and I took pigs to my county fair.
Oh, Christ.
Which helped put me through college. And I've castrated a pig before, so when you're telling me some of those things, I'm like, yeah, it brings back really.
Did you hold it upside
gross
down?
Memories.
Did you hold it upside down and cut into the stomach? The pig's testicles are on the inside.
Yeah, they're kind of on the inside. Yes, they're.
Oh, you're brave. That's crazy.
Well, thank you. I'm also courageous and a really good guy. So,
brave. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Sorry, I was trying to be funny.
Nice addition. Hey, I castrated a pig.
That's great.
John, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yep.
Great stuff with John Schroeder. It was awesome having him come on and join us. And, you know, good chance, Jason, for you to tell your big pig story. That was really wonderful. You probably got some other animal anecdotes that we could, some yarns that you could spin.
All I got to say is
about the Gallipolis days.
For those who visit the newsroom, for my coworkers who are in the newsroom, they could walk by my desk and see that I had the number one top barrow in the Gallia County Junior Fair, 1993 or something.
Oh, wow.
And I got a big trophy, 4-H, on my desk here. It's been all downhill ever since I won it. Back when I was 17 years old.
Hey, 4-H, man, 4-Hers, there's a lot of them out there. Outside of the Cincinnati area, there's a big 4-H community out there. People don't talk much about it.
You learn a lot. You learn a lot of responsibilities when you do a project, especially when it's an animal and a big animal, and hey, it helped pay for my college too. So,
all right, let's move it on. So that's the same moment this week. I think I got a good one because this past weekend, every February, my wife and I will go on a little long weekend away. You know, end of football season. Winter's getting to be a little bit too long. I just need that little break. So this can go somewhere, usually south. This year, we went to Charleston for a few days. Which, by the way, if you're looking for a good little getaway vacation, super interesting, unique town, great food. Turns out FC Cincinnati, by the way, ding, was down there. I had no idea, actually. So I was able to hang out and see Pat Brennan, our strong FC writer, who was down there covering their training that they're doing down in Charleston. So we were able to hang out and have dinner one night, but surprisingly. But anyway, so we're in Charleston. Great weekend. Fly back Sunday. They have Allegiant now has put in some direct flights. Otherwise, you could never get direct into Charleston. So it, you know, I'm not a big Allegiant guy, but I am a big direct flight guy
and cheap flight.
And it was cheap and direct, and so I credit them on that. So made for a quick little getaway. So the point is though, is there anything more Cincinnati than that flight back in the winter when you come back to the city, especially once you've gone to a southern destination, you've had some sun for a few days. It is always, every single time, the darkest, gloomiest, crappiest day, and you have to like descend down through the clouds, and you saw the sun, and then all of a sudden it's just getting darker and darker, and it's like everyone is another layer of gloom.
So, and doom.
And so this was the worst one I'd ever seen, though. So we went down through the clouds multiple times, and I kept thinking, man, we've really been in these dark, gloomy clouds for a long time. I feel like we should be landing sometime soon. Finally, the first thing I see when we come out of the clouds, we're basically on 275. Like, we were landing. And I was like, it is that thick and gloomy and overcast and awful here that it basically just live in the clouds and then land. But the story that I want to connect this to, that I always think of when I think of this, if I've got any Cosby Show fans in the house, okay, I know from back in the day, I grew up watching the Cosby Show. Season 4, there's an episode called Once Upon a Time, where basically Rudy is has written some story for her class, and it ends up coming to life, and they essentially act it out. And it's all about a happy land. Here's the actual Wikipedia. The happy land where the residents are taken prisoner by an evil king and his men. So all the happy people in happy land with like flowers and rainbows have to be taken over to this evil land where Cliff is like the emperor of evil. Well, they have to descend into it. And every time I fly in, I always think about going from happy land to the evil land, where everything goes from like rainbows to just dark and gloomy and black and just disgustingness. I always think of that. So if there's any Cosby fans out there that remember that episode, now you have a visual for life.
Hey, Buster, you don't like it here. You just go to happy land.
Yeah.
Hey, we like it here in Evil Land, man.
I know. That's basically, I think, what ended up being part of the episode.
Just take yourself right back down there to Charlestown or wherever you're going.
Hey,
if you don't like it, then you move down there.
Why is it always so gloomy and dark?
We like our gloom and darkness here, so.
I know.
Get off of it.
And I'm always... You don't notice it as much. I feel like you don't notice it as much when you're just here through the winter. It's just the way it is. You adjust yourself. But when you get that taste, like how the other side lives, it's much more noticeable, particularly when flying in.
I got a that's just insane moment of the week this week as well.
Courtesy, look at you, contributing.
Courtesy of Burl.
About damn time you contribute. Ding. All right, shout out, Burl. What do you got?
The Metro, bus, and the streetcar.
Ding!
Streetcar, colliding.
Oh, yeah.
Last week.
That was very Cincinnati.
That is very Cincinnati.
Yeah, really,
it's the second time it's happened. But it's just one more thing to add to the list. And that's enough on the streetcar. Now I have a curmudgeon moment of the week.
Yeah.
What is it? So we just remodeled our bathrooms here in the office, and they look great. They're great.
I thought we were going to go back and talk about your duct taped faucet again.
Still duct taped, still fine.
Still working.
Yep. Still
update.
Working.
Faucet's looking good.
Update, not worried about it.
Are you about to make a recommendation that you fix the faucets here at the office and
it brings back. What am I trying to say here? What I'm trying to say is I don't like those. I don't like those electric. Or censored.
I just
give me a knob to turn
the water
on.
Are you going to get into hand drying methods or electric faucet?
Yeah, the electric faucet. I can't talk right now.
Okay,
the electric faucet. It's like I wave my hand in front of it 3 times and it doesn't work. And I'm not ragging on our new bathrooms. They're great because this happens
almost anywhere you have an electric faucet like that. Just give me a knob. Let me turn it on. I'm responsible enough to turn it back off when I'm done.
Is this your polite way of telling your coworkers you haven't been washing your hands?
No, I have been washing my hands, actually. But I just stand there and I deal with it. I stand there and I wave my hand in front of the damn faucet three or four times and I say a curse word or something. And then finally the water comes on. I mean, the other problem is like, and then the water, it's just like a little squirt out water. It doesn't just stay on.
Right.
And it's so annoying.
You have unique preferences to how you want your hand wash method to occur. And you should not be held to the assumed restrictions that, oh, everybody washes their hands this way. No, Jason Williams uses a lot of water.
Not a lot of water, but I want to be able to use the amount of water I want to use.
That's true. Well, not anymore.
So there.
Welcome to the new world. That's a good curmudgeon moment.
There, I just yelled at a cloud.
You yelled at a faucet, technically, which I think is just as bad. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to That Cincinnati This Week. Again, reminder, if you've got emails and you'd like us to discuss any topics here in the TSC, send them to Jason J. Williams at Enquirer.com. We appreciate everybody's been listening. It's been great to see all of you jumping on board and our core audience growing. A lot of fun to have you here. Next week, my man Aaron Sharp will be talking about Bachfest, which he's at the forefront of. Talk about the Pendleton Good. Neighborhood and Lucius Q and life after WNKU off the air. A lot to talk with Aaron about. And I don't know if you know this, how I know Aaron was back when I worked at the Reds as a DJ. He's also a DJ at the Reds. He leads all the music there.
Is he a goat?
Works with what's that?
Is he a goat?
He's not a goat.
Greatest of all time.
He has a costume.
Greatest of all time.
I'm really against people using goat too much.
It gets overused.
It gets very overused. Especially. You can really own. There can only be one. So when you see like multiple goats in an hour online, I get a little frustrated.
Randy Moss is the goat.
He is potentially a GOAT receiver, but Jerry Rice would probably have a problem with that thought. I know, you just want to say go herd. I get it. I know. It's cool. Shout out to my man Phil on the ones and twos, producing us, does a great job. Hope you notice how much better everything has sounded since Phil has taken over and made things beautiful. So, P. Diddy, appreciate you as always. Anyway, we will talk to you next week on That's So Cincinnati podcast.